I'm told a few. Good morning. Welcome again. Today we are in our final morning meeting in terms of exploration of Shastra, exploration of our Gaudiya tradition, taking the hand of some of the main verses, taken by the hand of some of these important portals, again, not just a verse, but a sound portal, to access one particular facet of the jewel, of the infinite jewel of reality, where we have been going through different vantage points, speaking about sadhusanga, speaking about bhakti, descriptions of bhakti, attributes of bhakti, official definitions of bhakti, sadhusanga, the beginning, middle, and end, sadhusanga in terms of guru and disciple, fruits of all that in terms of relating to everything, receiving God's presence, and how that affects our relationships, and so on and so forth. Well, yesterday, we touched upon a beautiful portal from Brihadbhagavatamrita. Let's not call it a verse. Where Sanatana Goswami very mercifully reveals this uniqueness, this Raja Vidya, Raja Guhyam, these very confidential hidden treasures of how God becomes conquered and captured, crafted by, carved by, indebted by his devotees. He's ultimately the lover of his lovers. He's willing and capable of doing away with, throwing away so many of his attributes that classically define him, make him famous as God around the world. He's willing to throw all that and enter into the low profile of being a lover of his lover, a humble servant of his servants. And Sanatana Goswami will say, Bhagavata Simha, that's the summit of his being Bhagavan. Of God being God, the summit is forgetting that he's God and entering into intimacy, into relationship. So that's his most defining quality. God is a lover of his lovers. Bhagavan is a bhakta of his bhaktas, which is a very touching, moving, intimate portrayal of the sweet absolute. That makes for a sweet absolute, definitely. So today, the idea is to conclude our morning explorations with another verse that is coming in a minute. I'm not showing yet because you get too distracted by the verse while I'm trying to say something else over here. And you're all like taking notes. Relax, guys. Okay, we'll keep the verse in the whiteboard for the rest of the day. You want to copy? You can do it later. Relax. Relax. So today we'll be exploring one verse that hopefully somehow makes a tasteful full circle and summarizes many of the things we've been talking about. They say, oh, another portal, another window, in this case given by Srila Rupa Goswami. We will go to one verse from his book called Ujjvala Nilamani, where he will be speaking about again the sweet absolute and how the sweet absolute sees and feels for us, for everyone, not only for his devotees, for everyone. Or if we want to make the point, everyone is his devotee in potential. He's seeing every, I mean, everyone is dependent on him, sustained on him. And of course, again, how the last line, as we will see in a moment, is how we are invited to respond to that. How he sees and feels for all of us, how we are invited to respond. But before unveiling the mystery, we need some curtain or something. A few words on this book, Ujjvala Nilamani. It's a very interesting title of the book, Ujjvala Nilamani. Ujjvala Nilamani means something like blazing sapphire. Wow, that's good, huh? You generally don't hear about these two things combined. No? You don't think about the sapphire that is blazing. Blazing sapphire. Ujjvala Nilamani. Nilamani means literally means like blue gem or blue stone, but means blue stone means sapphire. And Nilamani and Uchbal means like resplendent, blazing. It's in one way, it's a way of speaking about Radha and Krishna. No, Krishna is the sapphire and Sri Radha is the golden, effulgent thing that is blazing in love. No? So blazing sapphire or Radha Krishna. So Uchbal Nilamani is Srila Rupa Goswami's sequel to Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. He wrote Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. And then he briefly touched upon Madhurya Rasa in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Because at one point he starts to talk about some Sandadasa Sakya Vatsalya Madhurya. When it comes to Madhurya Rasa, he says something, I mean, briefly, and the book continues with some topics and concludes. And we think, oh, he didn't say enough about Madhurya Rasa being Rupa Goswami immersed in that world. And he was like, no, wait, there's a book coming about that. The Ujjvala Nilamani is exclusively dedicated to the mood of romantic devotion, amorous love, with all its different possibilities and categories and subdivisions. It's a very comprehensive book, which has then being commented upon by Jiva Goswami and Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. So the context of the verse we will see today, which is the fourth verse of the 10th chapter. Let's talk about the verse without seeing the verse. Ujjvala Nilamani 10:4. This is called Udipana for Madhurya Rasa. So Udipana, as we may have, you may have known, means like stimuli. Stimuli also.
Stimuli. Stimuli.
Sorry, that's the pronunciation. Stimuli for Madhurya Rasa. Those things that somehow trigger, no, that the attraction in that direction. So Rupa Goswami said there are verbal ones, there are bodily ones, and there are mental ones. No, mental qualities in the sweet absolute, verbal qualities, physical qualities that
Stimulation.
stimulate, sorry, Madhurya Rasa. And then he will speak about mental qualities. He begins with mental qualities and he will mention gratitude, tolerance, and compassion. And next comes the verse we'll see today as an example of those. And we'll see. Each one of these lines is for each one of these qualities. It's funny to talk about that and you don't have the verse. Gratitude, first line, to keep that in mind. We'll go line by line. Tolerance, second line. Compassion, third line. And fourth line will be what that creates in us, how we become affected with that. So again, this verse will is somehow positioned in the book, in the Ujjvala Nilamani, in the context of Madhurya Rasa and Udipana for Madhurya Rasa, but also it can be applied and conceived more generally. So that's my point here. It's not like, okay, this exclusively for those who already have a taste for that. So if not, you won't get this verse. No, that is specifically applied there, but it can be applied in a more general way to all of us, no? By witnessing the sweet absolutes, again, gratitude, tolerance, compassion, and how that impacts in us, how we are invited ourselves to embrace those qualities in our own way, as we were talking these days, how to become godlike in that sense. Because Krishna, as we will see today, he's inviting us, become tolerant, become compassionate, but he's leading the way by example. So in that sense, we can become godlike, we can become imbued with the qualities that the divine is exhibiting in our own way, of course. Again, we are not God. So we are not entirely different or separate from the divine. So we are inseparable. So, yeah, that will be the exploration today. Do you agree? Contract sign? Check the small print, just in case. Yeah. So yeah, before going to the verse, one more thing is comes to my mind. The third verse of Shikshastakam, we'll find some parallels here because in the third verse of Shikshastakam, which we didn't explore these days because that deserves its own retreat, and we had that in New Zealand some years ago, and it's recorded, so don't complain. That's one of the most, if not the most important thing that Mahaprabhu said, golden rule of the golden Lord. Somehow it's a parallel. There he is inviting us to cultivate those qualities. In this verse, we'll see how God cultivates those qualities. So to make both are complementary, no? Because we may think, well, why I'm supposed to be humble and compassionate? Because he's too, I don't think he's leading the way. Now, in fact, it's interesting. In the Vishnu Sahasranam, these 1,000 names of God that appear in Mahabharata and other scripture, there are many names for the divine that actually totally related to this quality. For example, one name is Sahishnu. And you say, Tarorapi Sahishnuna. Sahishnu means tolerance. Sahishnu means tolerant. So he's saying, be tolerant, like a tree, but his name is Sahishnu. So he's not never asking us something he's not doing. No, that's a perfect example of proper leadership. No, if I ask you to do something, I'm already doing it. And if you are not doing it, I will do it. So he's known as Sahishnu. That's one name of him in the Vishnu Sahasranam. Another name, Vishnu Sahasranam, is Amani. No? Mahaprabhu is saying, Amani na manadena. No? Amani means basically have no pride, be free from pride. Amani na means be free from pride. Amani means he who has no pride. So he who says Amani na, please cultivate this, is Amani. He's already doing it. And then another name, just in case, is Manada. No? He says Amani na manadena. So Manada means he who gives honor upon everyone. So he's the one who, quote unquote, demands humility, tolerance, respect. He's the one who is walking the talk to begin with. So today's verse will be basically that, no? A verse that shows us how God is already walking his talk. And therefore, when he invites us to walk that talk, he's already leading by example. Right? Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, yad yada charati sristas, no? Whomever a great personality does, other people follow. So that's why he's the great personalities, the great test, he's doing it. So inviting us to participate, that's sadhana. That's a way we can define sadhana. Sadhana could be a way, could be defined as starting to participate in qualities that are already embodied by the Sweet Absolute, that characterize the divine, and how to divinize ourselves. Again, not to become Christian, not to try to compete, but how to relate to someone who is that. If I want to love someone who is grateful, compassionate, tolerant, probably it wouldn't do harm for me to imbibe those qualities as well, to better relate and understand that person, right? So in that sense, we can say this beautiful verse from today is coming as a beautiful companion to the third verse of Shikshastra, which we all know probably, which is again our most important instructor. So it's like a balancing to that. So when we go to the third verse of Shikshastra and we don't feel the weight, well, I have to do those things myself. No, they are already being done by the Sweet Absolute. So we can reciprocate to who he is, what he's doing in the same currency, in the market, the same currencies, compassion, gratitude, love. Oh, and all this will be in the context of love, as we'll see in the verse. Don't lose sight of love as the context of everything. So Krishna is grateful to his devotees, tolerant, compassionate, because he is love. You take out love and everything collapses. Okay. Let's bring it. Huh? So there we are. Now you can look at the whiteboard to your heart's satisfaction. Take nerdy notes, take pictures of the rooms. You can even take a selfie of yourself with the rooms. That's a new one, right? I don't think nobody has done that ever in their lives. We are starting a sampradaya here. Right? Taking selfie with the girl. That's how you start to participate in the verse. So, remember when we were in Kolkata in Back Bazaar Gaudiama, they had this video
Yeah.
of Gornitai dancing, and you could enter it with the camera and you could see yourself dancing. So that was a deep theological point of how you start to see yourself in prospect being there. So that's how you start to walk the talk of this. So, as I said, this is Ujjvala Nilamani, 10-4, blazing sapphire, 10-4. And here we have the verse. First line will be about, as I say, gratitude. Second line, tolerance, endurance. Third line, compassion. Fourth line, thirst and longing for all of that from our side. So I'll read the verse in Sanskrit and then I'll read the translation. It says, Basham alpikaya pi sevayamum vihite piyagasi dusahe smitasyam paradukalave pikataram me harim udbikshamanastano titrishna. Translation. Beholding the sweet absolute, brought under control by even the smallest service, smiling even when an unbearable offense is committed against him, and deeply distressed by even the slightest pain of another, my heart's thirst for him only increases.
Beautiful.
Beautiful because it's true.
Beautiful.
If all this will be delusional, you will feel, what's that nonsense? Wow. No. So the first line, we'll go line by line, right? It says about how Basham Alpi Kaya Apisivayam. Basham means under control. Alpikaya means even by some slight, Api means even, Alpika, Alpikaya, even by some slight Sivaya. No? Siva means some service, no? Sivaya. Amum means him. Him is referring to Krishna. He is brought under control even by the slightest service. Bihite means when something is committed. Agasi means offense. Api again. Even when an offense is committed. Dusahe means unbearable. And we'll give examples of this to illustrate. Even when an unbearable offense is committed, smitasya. Smita means smile. Krishna remains smiling. He never loses his smile. He remains smiling faced. Smitasya. Then Paradukha. Yesterday we briefly mentioned one name of God. Paradukha Dukhi. When someone is suffering, Paradukha means another suffering. Paradukha Lave. Lave means at the slightest portion, at the slightest suffering of another, api katarame, no? Katarame, distressed, no? Deeply affected. No? He's deeply affected at what witnessing, even the slightest pain in another. Therefore, me, Rupa Goswami said, me, I, and then comes the last line, harim udbhiksya manastanoti trishnam. Trishnam means thirst, no, thirst or longing. Harim means Hari. We are talking about Hari. Udbiksha means upon seeing, no, upon witnessing all these qualities, upon beholding that manas. Manas can mean my mind, but actually, generally, in India's expression, manas also means the heart. Generally, we make a difference. We say the mind is here in my head, heart is down here, but actually, my mind will be here. My mind, my heart. Tanoti Trishna. No, Trishna means thirst, and Tanoti means increases, intensifies. So my thirst for that Hari increases. No, my longing for Hari, and Hari, if we know, means thief. No, in other words, he's stealing my heart increasingly by showing all these qualities. I'm being captured by him. Just a short word by word introduction to the verse. So we'll go by one line by line, trying to go deep into each one of these qualities as much as we can in a few moments. I will also be sharing a few lilas from Shastra, from a scripture, like somehow exemplify each one of these qualities of compassion and gratitude and tolerance. And again, keep in mind, all these are expressed in the context of love, no? Because Bhagavan loves his devotees, Bhagavan loves everything and everyone. He acts as we are seeing in this verse. And that naturally invites us for to return and embrace accordingly. So let's go to the, keep that in mind. Let's go to the first line again. Basham alpikayapi sivayamam. He, this Hari, this thief of hearts, he's brought under control. We already talked about yesterday about that. That's why I say today's verse somehow continues with the theme of yesterday. God is controlled by his devotees, by love. He's brought under control. But now it's qualifying even more specifically, because some might say, yeah, he's brought under control by those who are super high, pure devotees who do everything and do everything perfect. And all and he's saying, Alpikayapi. He's brought under control by even the smallest service. Now, sometimes devotees have this idea, okay, to please Krishna, I need to collect $1 million and construct a temple that is like the biggest project of the community, or be the main book distributor, or be temple president, or take sannyas, or become a guru. It's all about like bigness. And this line says, emphasize smallness. Smallness in one sense, but bigness of heart, of course. At the end of the day, that's the only thing Krishna can look. Love is blind, no? To other things. It only sees, looks at the heart. So somehow, again, remember this verse, we made some connection with the third verse of Shikshastakam. So this first line makes me think of the first line, where Krishna Mahaprabhu is inviting us, be humble, like as the blade of grass. No? So if you're humble, you will be grateful. This line is about gratitude, right? Even the slightest service Krishna say you offer me, I'm totally under your control. Wow, that's disproportionately grateful, which means that proportionately humble. You cannot be grateful if you are not humble. One thing is feeding into the other. Humility and gratitude are intimately walk hand by hand together. They're very close friends. They are seen every day walking hand by hand in the village. Because the less entitled we feel, the more capacity we have, the more capable we become of experiencing even a slightest, even something small as a gift. The less entitled I feel, I put it that way. The less entitled I feel, the more capacity I have to experience something as small as a gift. Now, if I'm too very entitled, something small is not a gift. It needs to be something huge. Okay, now that's a gift. But if you are not entitled, which means you are, if you're humble, smallest detail is like, wow, that's a gift. And you, if you are the humblest, even almost nothing becomes the greatest gift. And that's who we are talking about here. Again, even small, the minimum thing, offer with a sincere heart, I'm indebted forever. Remember, like Krishna will say to Draupadi in the Mahabharata, after she called Govinda, Govinda, say that call of yours. And of course, that was not a small thing, but still we could say, okay, she was asking for she just called God when she was in need. And Krishna was saying, no, he's not saying, oh, you call me only when they were disrobing you. No? Of course, Draupadi is a pure devotee, so it's not just calling him there, but Krishna said, that call of yours at that moment has created a debt in my heart that has no end. Till today, I don't know how to pay back that. The quality, the intensity, the sincerity of that call has created a debt in my heart that's still increasing. So even the smallest service act can conquer the absolute, creates a debt in his heart. Krishna says in the second chapter of the Gita, Neha Vikramana Asusti Pratyavayana Vidyate Swalpam, Swalpam, again, Alpa, Svalpamapyasya dharmasya trayate mahato vayat. Even the slightest service, the slightest action on this path is never lost, it's never diminished, and will protect you from the greatest danger. Again, he said, using the word svalpa, alpa means even the smallest thing, the slightest thing, not to underestimate bhakti, the power of bhakti. And we were talking the other day about Teresa of Lisieux, little way. That's kind of alpa, little, small. Become small, do small. Again, it's not about let's try to impress my guru, let's try to impress my community, let's try to impress Krishna. No. Let's try to minimalize on the outside and concentrate on the inside and make a quality heart offering. Which externally may be very small, but internally is very deep and ornamented. So there are many examples in the scripture about that, no? That come to my mind quickly. The famous example in the Ram Lila where the squirrels were bringing their small things to build a bridge. And again, the monkeys and Hanuman are bringing these giant rocks, and the squirrels are bringing some pebbles. No? And the monkeys start like to bully the squirrels. Like, what's that? I mean, anyway, one rock I bring, I'm doing the work of 3 million of you. No? Something like that. And Ram immediately stops them, no? And like, starts to acknowledge how indebted he feels for he is, or for that slight service done with so much intentionality. Now going back to Anukul Yena Krishna Anushilanam Bhakti Rutaman. Our definition of bhakti some days ago, bhakti is to be performed with intentionality, favorable heart, deeply deeply chosen. Or when, I don't know, with Vidura's wife is offering Krishna a banana peel, the story also. That's not only a slight service, that's a messy one. Because you're not supposed to give God offer a banana peel. You can offer a banana, but you offer a banana peel in ecstasy in her love. Oh, Krishna not only putting the hand and receiving the offering, okay, and putting it somewhere else, because what you will do with a banana peel? He's eating the banana peel. And he's extending the hand again. He's eating love. That's his diet. Now, Krishna's diet is based upon bhakti. No, there's nothing else in his menu. No. Even if it takes the form of 3,000 preparations, they are all bhakti. If there's no bhakti, he's not hungry. He fasts. Or we, as we were saying the other day, speaking about gratitude, remember what we mentioned about this, the commentary of Vishwanathacharya. Krishna is grateful in advance for the offerings you have not even made to him yet. That's kind of like an extreme of that. You have not done certain offerings, but Krishna is looking at you like, in potential, you could do, you can love me in so many ways and offer this. I'm already grateful for that. I'm grateful for your prospect, for all that you can be in potential, for your unactualized potential. I'm already indebted and grateful for that. So, sounds too good to be true. It's too much to imagine. Someone that grateful? This verse is depicting that. The first line, someone very grateful. So gratitude has this quality. And again, let's try to remember when we speak about gratitude, it's not about just, oh, how nice that you, Krishna, are so grateful. It's good that you are grateful. Please keep cultivating that quality. It really suits you. The echo will say, and what about you? If you are so touched by that, it should touch you to the point of wanting to embrace equality. If not, it's not genuine appreciation. If I say, oh, how nice your humility. But if I'm not feeling invited to that, I'm not really appreciating deeply the humility. It's just like you continue to be the humble one, so I don't have to be that one. No. So it has to be, have to feel implicated no, while witnessing other people's. Well, you have to be affected, as we were talking all this, influenced. So gratitude means possessing that type of vision, no? Like when you see intention where other may see insufficiency. No? Someone say, oh, that's not enough, that's not too much, and you're actually feeling, wow, the intention there. No? No. Or seeing love where others may think, oh, that's unimpressive. But if there was genuine love and heart, that's impressive. So gratitude, it's very saragrahi quality, very essence seeker. It's a very important quality to cultivate. Sometimes we need to cultivate it consciously, make a conscious effort to be grateful. Many times we get absorbed in the things we lack and the problems we have and blah blah blah. We're a small petty
Yeah, I see.
world of concerns that sometimes we think, oh, this is the totality of existence. And you just need to take your mind and say, go pay attention to the things you have you can be grateful for. And the moment you focus in that direction, you realize, oh my God, there's so much there. Why am I not spending more time with my gratitude list? So anyhow, I like to share one main lila in this connection, which is very beautiful, and which is the story of Sudama Vipra.
I was just contemplating.
Yeah. Actually, at one point, to be honest, before deciding we will start different verse in the morning, I thought maybe just let's go through that section of the Bhagavatam because it's just so beautiful. So I'm sharing it in case you want to do it yourself as an extended homework during the coming months or weeks. But yeah, it's very, very touching in this particular connection. So as you may know, just to introduce the Lila Sudama, this is appears in the chapter 80 and 81 of the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam. Here Krishna is outside of Vrindavan already, he's in Dwarka. So he will meet Sudama Vipra. Vipra means Brahmin. And Sudam, because there are different Sudamas in the Lila. No? One is a Gopa in Vrindavan as well. So that's why I say Sudama Vipra. So Sudama was a classmate of Krishna when Krishna went to the Gurukul, Sandipani Muni's Gurukul. So Sudama and Krishna were classmates. So now they are meeting in Dwarka. Krishna's in Dwarka, pretty Aishwaric place. Krishna is like a king there with all his palaces and queens and opulence. And Sudama is an extremely poor Brahmin living with his wife. And it's described in the Bhagavatam, they were emaciated. Emaciated by hunger. It says like their veins were seen all over their body. Like it's a way of saying they were not eating enough. No. Very so at one point Sudama's wife says, Sudam, she was suffering for not only for her being hungry, but for her not being able to see her husband in that condition. Said, you are friends with Krishna from childhood, or you went together to Gurukul, and he's. I mean, they were aware Krishna is God, so there was this Aishwarya. So not only he's God, but he has lots of Aishwarya and opulence. Maybe he could help us a little bit in this condition. So Sudama agrees to go, mainly with the idea I'll have darshan of Hari. Though part of the idea, the intention was, okay, I will ask him for some financial help. But that was secondary or tertiary. The main thing was, and as we'll see, he ended up not asking for that help. His main intention was, I will meet Krishna, right? I'll meet my friend, my beloved, my Lord, different feelings, no? So he's asking his wife, but I cannot go with empty hands, no? I cannot just visit someone without a gift. And speaking about gratitude, again, they were completely poor. So his wife gives him like four handfuls. Handfuls, you say, of how do you call this? A flat rice,
Yes.
no? And they put it in a torn piece of cloth. It cannot get smallest than that, right? Simplest than that. No? So he goes there. He walks to reach Dwarka, and Krishna was at one point. He described about and in the palace, and in the distance he sees Sudama walking. So he's immediately leaves everything he's doing and runs to receive him and starts to bathe him with tears while embracing him. So I will be reading a few verses from that section because they clearly depict how. To begin with, again, we speak about first line, don't lose sight of this. Krishna is brought under control by the slightest offering. So how Krishna receives Sudama, how Krishna honors Sudama to begin with. Sri Krishna seated, this is verses 20 to 22 from chapter 80 of the 10th canto. Sri Krishna seated his friend Sudama up on the bed. Then the Lord, who purifies the whole world, personally offered him various tokens of respect and washed his feet, after which he sprinkled the water on his own head. The feet that washed his devotee's feet, he's putting them on his head. He anointed him with divinely fragrant sandalwood, agur, and kumkum pastes, and happily worshipped him with aromatic incense and arrays of lamps. So he basically treated him as a deity. No, he worshipped that. In fact, there's one verse in the Gita in the 18th chapter, Krishna tells to Arjuna, Ishtame. Like, in one sense, it's translated, you are my beloved friend, but Ishta can mean you are my Ishtadev. No, you are my worshipable deity. As we speak about Krishna as a worshipable deity, Krishna is speaking about that, and here he's treating Sudama, his devotee, as such. He's washing his feet, putting that on his head, decorating him, then offering arti to his devotee. After finally offering him betel nut and the gift of a cow, he welcomed him with pleasing words. So that's just a welcoming. God welcoming his devotee. So then, of course, the Bhagavatam goes on describing both taking each other's hands, again, like friends, and remembering together their times at the Gurukul and different adventures they went together in the Gurukul. And then Krishna asks Sudama, because Krishna is omniscient. Especially, he's not in Vrindavan, so his omniscience is more prominent in Dwarka. Say, oh, Brahman, what gift have you brought me from her? Because if, imagine after all this welcoming that Sudama received, he had these four handfuls of rice, and he was like ashamed. Like, how will I offer this to him? He hasn't met Krishna since they were friends in the Gurukul. So at that time, Krishna was just a friend in the Gurukul. And it's like your friend, the Gurukul, becomes like the king of the country or something. It's like you're in the palace and you're like, and you just brought like a candy as a gift. And I won't give this. So Krishna knows. Krishna knows, and Krishna is greedy for that and grateful for that. So he says, what have you brought me from home? I regard as great even the smallest gift after my offered by my devotees in pure love. But even great offerings presented by non-devotees do not please me. In other words, if there is no love, I'm not moved by that. I'm moved by love. So he's saying that to pacify Sudama. Even the slightest offering, I'm cherishing that. Because he knows, I know you are afraid of sharing that. And I'm really longing for that. And it's interesting because right after that verse, in the Bhagavatam comes the same verse of the Bhagavad Gita, Patram Pushpam Phalam Toyam Jome Bhakti Prayachati Tadaham Bhakti Paritamashnami Priyatatmanaha. 9:26 Gita, where Krishna says, if you offer me with love and devotion a flower, fruit, leaf, water, I'll accept it. That verse appears exactly the same in the Bhagavatam. Krishna to reassure Sudam, even one, that verse is one fruit. It's all in the singular. One leaf, one fruit, one water, which will be like one drop. But two times the word count, which means anything. I mean, one water, one drop. It doesn't matter, that's secondary, but twice the word comes, bhakti, in that verse. So flower, fruit, water, but bhakti, bhakti. Not twice. If there is bhakti, you even give me a flower and eat it. Bhakti-bhisharan-chagavati Thakur comments on the verse. The flower, I mean, some flowers are edible, but some may not. Usually people do not eat flowers. So the point made by Krishna is, even if you give me a flower with love, I will not only take the flower and smell it, I will devour it. Because your heart has been invested there. So Krishna's quoting this verse to Sudama. He's quoting Bhagavad Gita to assure him, like, if there is love, I'm taking it. So give it to me. No, I mean, I want the love you have in that pocket. Give it to me in the form of these four handfuls of rice. So, well, it is said that Sudama still was embarrassed in his humility, and he was like, with his head down, keeping his head low. And again, Krishna knew what Sudama had brought, and now he sees Sudama with his head low, and he thinks, now is the chance. So he goes and snatched the rice because he had the torn piece of cloth with rice like tied to his cloth, so he knows it's that thing there. So he measures and he snatches. And then Krishna says, "My friends, have you bought these for me? It gives me extreme pleasure. Indeed, these few grains of flat rice will satisfy not only me, but also the entire universe." Gratitude. And then he starts to eat them. And everyone in the palace is what's going on. But again, everyone knows Krishna and Dwarka as a prince, as a king, a certain version. This Brahmin, poor Brahmin, rag Brahmin, emaciated Brahmin. Who is this person that Krishna's worshipping with his coming and decorating and now snatching? I mean, he's used to eat royal menus and now he's greedy, devouring this flat rice. And everyone's getting a little confused. So after a few handful of Rukmini, King Krishna's queen's like, "Stops, Krishna. It's okay. You make your point. It's fine." Everyone in the palace is getting like a little confused by your behaviors. Again, we are not in Vrindavan. In Vrindavan, that will never stop. Nobody will stop. We are in Dwarka. There's another decorum here. So anyhow, that's day one of Sudama's visit to Krishna. And remember, originally the plan was to request him some financial help, but that's not happening. So the next day, Sudama returns home after being with his friend. Again, he never dared to ask for Krishna for financial help because he already felt, "I received so much from him. No, don't seeing him, just seeing him, being with him. What to speak of how he received me and honored me and expressed gratitude and affection for my insignificant, in his opinion, insignificant gift." So he was, the Bhagavatam reflects that when he was returning from Dwarka to his house, he just couldn't stop reflecting, how Krishna received me, treated me, worshipped me, how he was so grateful, basically. Remember, don't lose sight, we are studying this one first line. Again, what makes the offering precious is not the external amount, but the amount of heart, invested within it, the amount of heart contained within it. So Krishna saw one grain of rice, but so, wow, such an amount of heart can enter in one grain of rice. It's something like that. So then Sudama starts to weep, moved by this while returning, and he thinks like this. No? He says, "Sri Krishna is known to be devoted to the Brahmanas, and now I have personally seen this devotion." He was a Brahmin. Indeed, not only a Brahmin, but also Brahmin. "Indeed, he who carries the goddess of fortune on his chest has embraced this poorest beggar. Who am I? A sinful poor friend of a Brahmin. And who is Krishna, the Supreme Absolute? Yet he worshipped me as if I were a god." And then he reflected. Because again, he's aware Krishna's God. So he's aware also Krishna knew that I went to him for financial help, though I never say anything. So Sudama reflects, thinking, "If this poor wretch suddenly becomes rich, he will forget me in his intoxicating happiness. The compassionate Lord did not grant me even a little wealth." No. So that's how Sudama is thinking, no? How Krishna thought, in his opinion, Sudama's opinion, because that's not the end of the story. Oh, Krishna knew, I didn't tell him anything, but he knew, but he thought, if I grant this guy some wealth, he will go mad. So he didn't give me anything of that. And he felt gratitude for that. So he's protected me. So he's never thinking, why you didn't give me anything? But the point is, he's thinking like that, he starts to arrive to his house, which was a very little cottage, emaciated cottage, as he was. And he starts to see in the way like a rise of servants and lakes and palaces. And it's like, oh, I think I got the wrong GPS address. I went to the wrong village because what's all this opulence, no? And different. And there's a whole detailed description of everything, jewel embedded and servants and musicians and like a heavenly planet, and he sees his wife coming, you know, like a goddess of fortune, and he realizes that Krishna actually, without saying anything, he fulfilled in excess all that he never said, right? So it's not that Krishna was ungrateful and didn't. So then again, Sudama reflects. He says, thus, even though he said nothing about it when I stood before him, he actually bestowed upon me the most abundant riches. This way he acted just like a merciful rain cloud. Which that's the name of Krishna, Ghanashyam. No, his hue is like the rain cloud, no, like just about to pour abundant rain. So that's another way of speaking about God's unconditional love, because when it rains on everyone. Rain is not selective. No, I rain on you, but not on you who are walking next. Of course, we can hide from the rain and do not experience the grace of rain, the rain of grace, but we are exposed. It's raining upon all of us. And then Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur makes a very interesting comment here. Very beautiful. This is to verse 34 of chapter 81 of 10th canto. Why Sudama compares, he says, Krishna acted like a merciful rain cloud. Remember, Krishna didn't say anything. Oh, I will bestow riches. I know you are coming for that. When you return home, he didn't say anything. It was all done very low profile, secretly. And when Sudama Rai was like, what's this? So he acted like a merciful rain cloud. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments in this way, because you can, again, understand rain cloud that I just explained. Abundant, copious, generous, indiscriminate. But he makes a very interesting point. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, embarrassed at being unable to properly reciprocate with Sudama's offering, Sri Krishna bestowed his favor on him silently. Right? He felt, if I tell you, if I give you this clearly, it's embarrassing for me because I feel that all this I'm giving you is nothing compared to what you gave me. Going back to this line, brought under control by even the slightest offering. Krishna acted just like a magnanimous rain cloud, which provides the necessities of life for everyone, near and far, but feels ashamed that its rain is too insignificant a gift to give in return for the abundant offerings that farmers make to it. Out of shame, the cloud may wait until nighttime, when the farmers are asleep, before watering their fields. This is the position of Krishna, the best of the generous. Wow. That's beautiful, right? So that's why he compared him to a rain cloud. As a rain cloud pours rain at night, because the rain cloud feels ashamed to do it in the day because these farmers are worshiping me, offering, doing offering. I can't reciprocate to that. When they are sleeping, I'll try to do something, but it's too embarrassing for me. The same way Krishna did bestow all that silently, secretly, feeling embarrassed because whatever I'm giving is nothing comparison to what I give. So that's beautiful. And then in the next verse, Sudama concluded. That's the conclusion. Sudama says, Sri Krishna considers even his greatest benedictions to be insignificant, in humility and gratitude, while he magnifies even a small service rendered to him by his well-wishing devotee. So on his side, he feels whatever I'm doing is insignificant, but whatever he receives, is magnifying that out of gratitude, out of humility. Thus, with pleasure, the Supreme Lord accepts a single palmful, accepted a single palmful of the flat rice I brought him. This goes back to again our first line, right? The sweet absolute brought under control, but even the smallest service. So gratitude, line one. And humility again, deeply connected one with the other, and how it invites us to embrace the same. Again, I leave it to you to contemplate. Okay, this is the God I'm worshiping, I'm adoring. How is that inviting me to become like him to enter into relation with such a grateful, loving, humble person. Again, witnessing all the things, it becomes easier to become humble. Humble is not like you have to be humble, you have to be grateful. It's like you hear this, you melt, and you're like, how can I not? I cannot but. Okay, we move to the next line. Again, we could just stay with this line for eternity, and we will, hopefully. That's the only way you can access eternity. Let's go to the second line, which speaks about tolerance. Bihite piyagasi Krishna is smiling even when an unbearable offense is committed against him. Smiling when something unbearable is done unto you. Imagine, we will be cursing, killing, reacting, accusing, victimizing ourselves, not smiling. It sounds like Jesus' line in the Bible, no? When turn the other cheek. Again, and this has to be understood in a realistic, sustainable way, not in a way that lends up itself to abuse or anything, but there's a beautiful way to understand this idea of tolerance, basically. And this line is about tolerance, which can be a parallel with the second line of Shikshastakam. Remember, we are making some connection with the second, with that verse, Tarori Apisahishnuna. Be tolerant as the tree is tolerant. Tolerance, but also forgiveness. No? That's the ultimate intent. Tolerance is not just I'm tolerating, but I'm giving while like the tree is giving, I'm forgiving, giving and forgiving while tolerating. Krishna is smiling and loving while receiving some whatever attack, as we will see in a moment. Let's see if you can guess which will be the story I will be telling to you in that connection. But again, remember, in a healthy way, this needs to be embraced. So Mahaprabhu said, be tolerant like a tree. What's the implication? Like the first line said, be humble like the blade of grass. Blade of grass bends without breaking. So bend in a way that doesn't break you. Then he says, be tolerant like the tree. The tree can just stay and deal with outer conditions called and not be uprooted and fall. You have to be uprooted. As uprooted as you can, you grow up, the tree grows upward in the same proportion that it's growing downward. Or even it's growing more downward than upward. So, in other words, you cannot expect to tolerate or transcend if you are not rooted enough. So, you have to act proportionately to your rootedness, to your realization. If you try to tolerate beyond that, it's not healthy. So, that's in the example that Mahaprabhu is giving. Just for us to read these lines in a healthy way and nobody feeling like it's too much. And right again, Krishna is leading the way. So it can be tolerance, but also it can be forgiving. We are talking about forgiveness here as well. And forgiveness, as we say many times, doesn't mean we were talking about that yesterday. Forgiveness doesn't mean pretending that nothing happened. Oh, it's okay, I forgive you. But forgiveness means, how to say, refusing to let the wound be the final word, or refusing to let the wound be the final definition, and even the capacity to be nourished by the wound. Forgiveness entails all that. It's a process, of course. It's not the one act performance. So we are being lovingly endured by the divine in our heart, as I always like to say, after witnessing who knows how many crazy stuff going on in our many lifetimes. Paramatma never left us saying, I'm done with you. Yeah. Right. Look for another inner witness. It was truly too much. Not only he is not leaving our heart, but his loving presence is increasing at every moment. We need to use some humor to speak about a few tragic things, right? So perhaps one form of grace is that God simply stays in our heart. That's part of his grace. Despite so many stuff, he's not leaving. And that's not only the only thing he does, but just staying like a very loyal friend. Not like the example given in Shastra, Suparna, these two birds. Now, one is completely absorbing, tasting the fruits of the tree, which implies living in a fruitive way, exploitative way. And the other friend is watching, trying to say something, but not leaving the tree. It's like, come on, you are so busy. Imagine if we are with someone and the other person is all day eating or doing their own stuff. They never pay attention to you. At one point, they continue with your thing. I have to live my life. In this case, the second birth, which is God in the heart, is never leaving. Staying, waiting, trusting, trying to exert some positive influence, but also allowing my free will to play out. So, waiting and forgiving. Again, while tolerating, forgiving. The two go hand by hand. So tolerance becomes nourishing. It's interesting. In the Bible, Jesus associated forgiveness with breathing in one section, no? Which is, again, breathing is the one activity that is accompanying us from birth till death. Now, that's the only thing you never stop doing. He made some comparison between breathing and forgiving, like implying you are invited to forgive at every step. There's so much to be forgiven because we are being forgiven at every step. So, again, it's not a disproportionate demand. And there's no end to forgiveness. That's an important point because and it's also to yourself. Again, self-forgiveness is also part of the equation. But you can always deep forgive something deeper and deeper. It's not just like I forgive you or I don't forgive you. It's not just something so reduction. Okay, I forgive you. So there's no more need to forgiveness. You can always forgive deeply. Deeply, deeply. Forgive yourself, forgive others, and be forgiven as well. So forgiveness is not so much something that God performs, but something that God is. It's an expression of love, God is forgiveness. It's like he's breathing. Again, going back to the Bible example, he's breathing forgiveness. Inhale, exhale. The Srimad Bhagavatam gives a very interesting image in this regard, which is it gives example of a baby. God is like a mother in this case, which is a very healthy way of thinking about the divine also, not only as a father, not only masculine side, but the feminine side, we have the divine couple. So like a mother who is pregnant and he's having the child in the womb. Some of you, of course, the mother present here will have tangible realization of that, and the child is kicking in the womb. Oh. So the mother has to tolerate the kicking, but at the Bhagavatam said, God is like the mother, and we are the baby in the womb. Oh. Kicking. No. Ah. But the mother, rather than being irritated, takes the kicking as, oh, each movement is announcing or confirming there's life there. It's a confirmation. It's joyful. Now, rather than why you are kicking, stop kicking. Like, whoa, we did kick. It's like maybe at some point, okay, too much life here. But the main idea is, oh, it's joyful. It's announcing life. It's a trailer of what's to come. So he said the same way God is dealing with us. Now, God is the mother, and we're in the womb, and we are kicking. We're not behaving that beautifully, but in his forgiveness and compassion and all this quality goes like, oh, it's not like irritated. No, it's tolerating from love. But even you may not even need to use the word tolerating because what it's done in love is just like, sweet kicking, right? And since we are talking about kicking and talking about tolerance, there's one story that we need to bring to the table. Karuneshwari knows what we're talking about here. So we'll go to this lila from the Bhagavatam where kicking is big prominent part of it, but tolerance as well, loving tolerance and something way beyond that as we'll see. We'll see how God tolerates. And when you see that, you relate, is that tolerance at all? Can I still call that tolerance? Still call that forgiveness? Or it's just like an overflow of love? And that's the story of Bhrigu Muni. That one you will find, just in case, in chapter 89 of the 10th canto, the Srimad Bhagavatam. In other scriptures as well, but in the Bhagavatam. So once upon a time, there were groups of sages, and they were pondering the position of this tree, one of these many Hindu trinities, Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva. And sometimes there are still these debates, okay, who is the supreme among these three, who is higher, and this and that, who is the chief deity, Brahma, Vishnu, or Shiva? So they were like pondering how to solve that question. So they planned some very interesting strategy. So they called Bhrigu Muni, who is one of these main sages. There are seven great sages in the Hindu lore, and Bhrigu is one. And he's a son of Brahma, actually, Brahma. So they sent him on a mission. So they spoke to his. And then Bhrigu goes. No? So first he went to his father's court, to Brahma. And the mission was to put to test each one of these three by different forms of apparat and see how they react. So the yardstick will be in terms of tolerance, interestingly, the second life. Intolerance, and according to that, he will confirm who is the supreme deity. So first he goes to Brahma, and Brahma was situated in the mode of goodness when Bhrigu appeared. He was sitting there, but Bhrigu entered and he failed to bow down to his father, or to glorify him with prayers. So and mentally he kind of criticized him. So he did mental apparat. And we'll see that the three ways he reacts with each one of the deities is a grosser apparat than the previous one. So it begins with mental, then verbal, then physical. So with Brahma, it's mental apparat, not saying some things and mentally not being so appreciative. So Brahma became angry immediately and was like inflamed, into fury. But somehow Brahma was able to subdue that. It was like a first reaction. Like you enter, you are not respecting, and you're thinking something ill about me in your mind. So with his intelligence, he was able to bring himself back to compose himself. So Brahma was like, okay. Took note of case number one. Case number two, Brahma is going to Mount Kailash to visit his brother, Shiva, because Shiva is born from Brahma. Bhrigu is born from Brahma. So so far he's keeping in, it's a family affair. So Shiva is seeing his brother coming. So he's in Kailash city. He stands up and very happily say, "Welcome, brother." And he goes to embrace him. And Bhrigu is like, "Don't touch me, right? I cannot touch you. You're a deviant heretic." No, verbal apparat. So he starts to insult Shiva. "You're already surrounded by these ghosts and dressing with ashes and like all this weird stuff you do. Don't touch me." Again, he's testing Shiva. And at this, Shiva becomes enraged, with his brother. And his eyes start to become red, fiery like. He takes his trident. He takes his trident. And he's about to kill his brother. And Parvati comes into the scene to save the situation. And fell at Shiva's feet and begged, "Please, don't kill your brother." No. And her words pacified him. So Bhrigu's like, make a note, or crossing the names, basically. So then we have the last person to be tested, who is Vishnu. So Bhrigu goes to Vishnu by Kunta. So I will read the verses because this deserve specific reading to see how Bhagavan reacts to Bhrigu's act. Bhrigu then left the place. Kailash, again, taking notes, I went to Vaikuntha, where Vishnu resides. There he went up to the Supreme Lord, who was lying with his head on the lap of his consort, Lakshmi, Narayan in Vaikuntha, and kicked him on the chest. It cannot get more horrible than that. So this physical apparatus is even worse than just speaking or just thinking. It's like, boom, gross. And putting your feet on God's, not only putting your feet on God's chest, but kicking violently. The Lord then rose. Someone will think, what is this Sudarshan coming? Brigwa at this point was like, Sudarshan anywhere? It's like he went with a scarf. Just the Lord then rose along with Goddess Lakshmi as a sign of respect. Because they were lying. So if you have a guest coming, you are lying internally. You're not just, hey. So he woke up. It's a sign of respect. Coming down from his bedstead, that supreme goal of all pure devotees, Vishnu, bowed his head to the floor before the sage and told him, welcome, Brahmana. Please sit in this chair and rest a while. Kindly forgive us, dear master, for not noticing your arrival. And then Bhagavan continues. He tells the Brigva, please purify me, my realm, and the realms of the gods by blessing us with the water that has washed your foot. This water alone makes all sacred places sacred. Today, my lord, I have become the exclusive shelter of the goddess of fortune, for your foot has sanctified my chest. So that's how Vishnu reacted to him. So let us not miss the reversal. This is God speaking to his devotee. You can take all this out of context. I don't tell you who is talking to whom, and you think, oh, that's the devotee praising God, right? No, no, it's not the way we are. So that's how Bhagavan reacted. No, no Sudarshan, no trident, no red fury eyes, no, he's begging forgiveness, offering seed, praying to the feet of Bhrigu Muni and saying, the water that washed your feet, please give it to me, like he did with Sudan, so I can be purified. So now Bhrigu had a clear answer. Mission accomplished. No? And which was Bhrigu Muni's response to this? Devadatta said, overwhelmed with devotional ecstasy, he remained silent, his eyes brimming with tears. What can you say on top of that? So he could just like, this is too much. Not only he, again, that's how he tolerates. That's how God tolerates. Is that tolerance? Is you follow my point? It's not okay. I'm tolerating. I'm not killing you. Keep him. No, that's not how he's tolerating. That's what he is saying here. Oh, smiling. And the smile represents not only just smile, because you can fake a smile or just smile, but internally, a smile represents a really favorable attitude with all that it entails, like we are sharing here. So a few words on this second line. Bhagavan smiling even when unbearable offenses committed against him. So again, it's Bhagavan is so loving, so humble, so grateful, as we talked before, that his tolerance doesn't feel like he's tolerating at all. When you are with someone who is totally loving, they do not need to tolerate in one sense. They are beyond tolerance. They don't feel, I have to tolerate this. It's just, they are loving. Tolerance has become upgraded to love. So it becomes a natural expression of love. That's why I'm connecting all these qualities with love. For us in the beginning, if we lack that love, okay, I have to tolerate. And I understand why it's good for me to tolerate. It's more a calculated process. But when you are deeply immersed in love, you're not even thinking about tolerating anything. You're just loving. Like Jesus would say, love your enemy. Not even tolerate your enemy. Love your enemy. So when you love your enemy, you don't see an enemy. I kind of love you if I still see you as my enemy. So you are no longer my enemy and I love you. And if I love you, I don't even think I have to tolerate you. So those things are left far behind. So, okay, many of the things may be a gradual aspiration for us to cultivate, because to think of how, where do I find myself in my journey in connection to this? But it's, again, it's always, I think, healing and hopeful to know, okay, I'm worshiping, I'm adoring someone who is embodying this in the most loving, beautiful way. Okay, let's move to the next slide. Ora du colave picatra me. Rupa Goswami says, this Hari is deeply distressed by even the slightest pain of another. Deeply distressed. Kataram means deeply distressed by even lava, like lava matra sadhu sangha. Lava means the smallest para dukkha, suffering in another. So that speaks about his compassion. So far, line one, gratitude. Line two, tolerance. Line three, compassion. Which again, all those are love. That's the point. When you love, or where you are love, in this case, like Bhagavan is, yes, it doesn't take an effort. It's not like he, okay, I have to be grateful. No, it's not like he's forcing himself. I will go to my gratitude list. I have to tolerate. I have to be compassionate. It will be good for me. We may begin from that more primitive place, but for him, it's just like the natural, obvious, unavoidable response. So compassion, that's more related. Of course, it can be related going back to the Shikshastakam with the second line as well, but also with Amanina Amanadina, to offer and respect, not expecting anything from you. So Bhagavan is, here we have Paradukha, which means another's suffering. And as we were mentioning yesterday, one name for God is Paradukha Dukhi. So Paradukha means affliction, suffering. Para means someone else. And Dukhi means he who is afflicted by someone else's affliction. Paradukha Dukhi, he who suffers when someone else is suffering. That's why Krishna in the Gita says the symptom of a yogi is that he makes other people's suffering his own. And again, he's just saying that about us aspiring yogis, but he is leading the way by being Paradukha Dukhi, by being Karuna Sindhu. Oh, that's the name. There are so many names of Krishna. Kripa Ma, he's made of mercy. Karuna Sindhu, he's ocean, an ocean of grace. His compassion is oceanic. Ocean means you don't see the beginning or the end of that. It's unfathomable. Compassion, as we were saying yesterday, right? Suffering with. He enters into relationship with us, enters into our wound, enters into our pain, and suffers with us. There are many ways, words in Sanskrit for compassion. I mentioned them in my forthcoming book. It's anugraha, anukampa, kripa, karuna, prasadai. And each one offers a unique perspective of compassion. But this word anukampa is beautiful. Anukampa means, it's not here, I'm just bringing it. Kampa means to tremble. And anu means to follow, well, the trembling that follows. Like we were saying, anugatya, the raga anuga. Anukampa means to tremble accordingly. Like you are trembling, I'm trembling. So that's the word for compassion. Like I'm seeing you're trembling in terms of your suffering. I'm trembling accordingly. I'm empathizing with your, what's shattering you. So again, compassion begins when the other person's suffering stops to be merely information, right? And in one way, it becomes an event within us. We were saying yesterday, it's not a passive, distant witnessing. Oh, you're suffering. That's still information. No, but when it becomes an event within us, then we are talking about compassion. Then we are talking about suffering with. And at the same time, we're talking these days, all this has to be done, embracing a sustainable way with discernment. Compassion requires discernment because feeling another's pain also doesn't mean absorbing that without limits. That can be overwhelming. If we are not an ocean of compassion, we can drown in the ocean of the other person's distress. So the question is how to let the other person's suffering touch us deeply, no? Or how can we allow ourselves to be touched by the other person's suffering in a way that evokes a loving response in us, without becoming incapacitated by the other person's suffering, without becoming like frozen or overwhelmed or bewildered, but touched by a loving response. So each one has to assess their adhikar. I'm losing a few of you, sir. Oh, buddy. Stretch a little bit, deep breath, few more minutes. There's no window door to open.
Door.
I mean, that's up to you. I cannot be organizing that one. Yeah, of course. Self-compassion, a little bit of oxygen and stretching, compassion to the body. So, but yeah, a few words on compassion so we can also embrace in a way that is not bewildering us. It's sustainable for us. And that's the yardstick. How am I contacting other person's suffering evokes in me a loving response and not something negative. And each one will have a different measure for that. So you have to ascertain your adhikar. That's a daily exercise. What can I deal with? Little slightly outside of the comfort zone, and but still sustainable. And one example in this connection, since we have been sharing a few narratives about gratitude, then tolerance, about compassion, there are many. Like we shared the other day about puttana, something utterly disproportionate. But one in connection to this particular line, how Bhagavan is deeply distressed, even by the slightest pain of another. Again, these lines try to give this disproportionate thing. Deeply distressed, related to the slightest pain. Deeply brought under control by the smallest offering. No. No. And so on. Deeply tolerant with the most unbearable offense. So it's putting it into the two extremes to show, okay, here we have a golden standard of this. So a beautiful example that I always like to bring about in this connection is that of Advaita Acharya. Let's go to Gaur Lila for a moment. From Bhagavatam to Bhagavatam. Srimad-Bhagavatam to Chaitanya Bhagavatam. No, and again, Advaita Acharya is Mahavishnu. Mahavishnu is God in connection to this world. Let's put it that way. We are not talking about someone else. Remember, we are not poly. Theistic people, like many gods, it's one, appear in different forms. So in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it is described how Advaita Acharya, Mahavishnu, God in connection to us in the world and us here, he's beholding the suffering of the world. Now he takes a look at the suffering condition of souls, of us. And unconditional love shatters his heart. Basically, in that moment, the pain of every living being that he's witnessing, our pain, becomes his own. He engages in this compassion. And he's unable to bear it in silence, so starts to call for Mahaprabhu to descend, which is this funny because this is God calling for God to descend. And one asks Mahavishnu calling for Swayam Bhagavan Krishna. Right? So it's in that cry, he starts to cry. He starts to cry out calling, by compassion, by contacting our suffering. So his compassion for suffering and the longing for God became one. Interesting, in Advaita Acharya, witnessing the suffering connected with it, longing for God merged into one single cry, so to say. And that, how do you say in English, summoning? Summoning God to come in the most volcanic and compassionate form possible, we conceive of like Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. No? But that was, I mean, in one sense, that the reason why Mahaprabhu came. There are many reasons, of course, but this one important one. So again, Advaitacharya saw the suffering. His first reaction was not, let's try to explain why suffering exists. Now, he responded immediately by allowing the suffering to break him open. That was his first intuitive answer. So it's not like, let's philosophize about the reason for the suffering. That may come at one point. We may need to, but first it's like, let me contact that. Sometimes, yeah, compassion begins before theology has an explanation or an answer. And it's interesting because generally we hear the main reasons for Mahaprabhu's descent are these three main reasons. He wants to experience Radha's love and the beauty she perceives in him and the joy she perceives by witnessing his beauty. And the secondary reasons are establishing Yuga Dharma and Advaitacharya's call. But there's one verse in Chaitanya Charitamrita that describes Advaitacharya's cry as the principal cause for Mahaprabhu's descent also. So that's another way to emphasize the importance of God's compassion. So we are here because of Advaitacharya's compassion. We could put it that way. No. God looking at creation compassionately, suffering with us, invoking the necessary manifestation, necessary grace to deal with our case, right, in the form of Sriman Mahaprabhu. So, few thoughts on the third line. I'm trying to be a little brief, so because I'm losing a few of you. But I think that's very important. No? The example of Advaitacharya gives suffering a very, how to say, an extraordinary theological dignity, we could say. You know, the cry of living beings matter enough to move heaven. The cry of living beings matter enough to move heaven. So that gives suffering an extraordinary theological dignity. Because sometimes, again, we are suffering deniers. Oh, that's suffering. That's bad. That's just a symptom of illusion. That's bad. That's wrong. Get rid of it. That's moving heaven. So to say, the cry of the living beings is moving heaven, making heaven, moving heaven to the point of descending, to pour again, rain cloud. So the pain of the world is not invisible to God. Again, let's be careful not to posit God as if aloof personality, indifferent to what's going on here. And perhaps our own compassion, again, there's always a call for us. Our own compassion becomes one of the ways in which, through which the divine response enters the world. It's not just, okay, whenever Krishna wants to descend again to save these guys, you can come, Krishna. It's time. It's good time to come. But why not allow that to descend through you? That's part of the invitation, part of the commitment. So anyhow, some words about the third line, compassion. Sometimes it, for us to make it personal, and we'll make it personal in a moment with the exercises, of course. But also the question, no, it's not so much, I am compassionate, I'm not compassionate, but many times where the struggle lies, like who's suffering, I don't know, whose suffering do I find easiest to ignore? Because sometimes we can be selectively compassionate. And ultimately we are invited to embrace universal compassion. Because universal love means universal compassion. But before concluding and going to our practical embodiment of today's lesson, we have one more line, the last line. And the word may also, because may means me. Remember, this is Rupa Goswami's praying, concluding this verse. Actually, in the commentary, it is mentioned that the verse, maybe it was composed by Rupa Goswami, but it's more speaking about one commentator is Satyavan quiz Radha, in case in Dwarka Lila, speaking regards Krishna. But he said, me, and we can, I would say, impersonate, we can own the me, Harim Udbiksham Anastanoti Trishnam. After seeing all these, this quality of Hari, again, Hari the thief, I'm being stolen by that, I'm being captured by these qualities, Tano Ditrishnam. In my heart's thirst for Hari, Tanoti, can only increase. Can only increase. My heart's thirst for him only increases. The longing and aspiration. This has been a theme throughout these days. Longing, aspiration. So again, the verse is not ending with any command. Okay, because Krishna is dead, now you do it. No, but it's ending with attraction. After witnessing all that, I cannot but feel drawn in that direction, to that Hari. Again, Hari is a thief, but he's stealing hearts by just being who he is. It's not like a forceful thief. I'm like, give me your heart. No, but just being who he is, he's stealing everyone's heart by being so grateful, so compassionate, so tolerant. Naturally, I'm stolen, captured by him. After beholding such qualities, the heart naturally says, I want more of this God, right? And it's never enough. I want more of this. I kind of never get enough of this. Hari, as we already seen, and Krishna will say the same in connection to us. I want more of these guys. I want more of this heart. That's why we need an eternal spiritual world, because everyone wants more of that. I want a part two and a part three and part 108. So this is one of the healthiest foundations for our sadhana. Again, not merely obligation, not merely fear, not fear at all, not even spiritual ambition, but fascination. That's the last line of this verse, fascination. After witnessing how, in which way, in which quantity, in which quality Hari is now grateful, tolerant, compassionate. I'm fascinated by that. My thirst is increasing. So this is kind of a, we have making parallels with the third verse of Sikshastaka. So now we have the last line of Sikshastaka, Kirtaniya Sada Hari. Always engaging in kirtan of Hari. Again, the word Hari is coming here. Kirtaniya Sada Hari. You say Hari. So from that place, you are invited to engage perpetually in Sankirtan, from a place of fascination and longing and irresistible attraction to Hari, to he who by his very qualities stealing away your heart. It's irresistible, it's too much. And I think longing also is very important, because longing is, how to say, protecting our aspirations from perfectionism. No? Like, it keeps the door open for more longing. Perfectionism is, I have to do it perfect, it's like this, game over. So we do not need to embody everything that we have contemplated this week. Now, we have contemplated a lot of things this week. We don't need to immediately embody that. No, it is enough to long for that. Right? It's a lot to long for that. This week we try to sow some seeds of longing in the heart. No? It is enough that something within us begins to thirst for the things we have been sharing. That's what this verse is saying. No? Seeing all this, I have thirst for that more and more. It doesn't mean I'm already there. It doesn't mean I will ever be fully there, because you can never be fully there. But I'm perpetually longing for that. And if you have that longing, then your life is completely successful. Like Prabhupada Nanda Saraswati says in Radharasa Sudhanidhi, he's praising Sri Radha, and he's like overwhelmed, like, wow, this is such a deep, great, beautiful idea, but who am I to long for that? Where I am? And he concludes, well, and who am I to attain that? Is there hope for me to ever attain that? So much. He said, well, but even if I can die longing for that idea, my life is successful. Because sometimes we become a little bit obsessed with attainment. No? You have to get there, you have to achieve it. No? Achieving mentality. You have to develop pure love, become there, enter Golok Vrindavan, whatever. If Prabhupada said, if I can just die longing for that, die thirsting for that, then my life is successful. My trajectory is successful. Because if I die longing, that warrants what will happen after that. Dying that way, longing for that will make me closer to that. So that's a good way to deal also with shame, in the sense of sometimes we feel I want something and I'm falling short of that, and we feel shameful. Why instead not take that as longing for that? So the distance between, in other words, the distance between who we are, and what we have glimpsed, all that I can be, the distance between that doesn't need to become shame. It can become longing. Follow my point? I'm here and this is all that I can be. I'm glimpsing my potential. Wow. There is a big distance between the two. I have two options. I can feel ashamed. I'm so far from that. I'm blah, blah, blah. Or I can turn that into longing. Of course, I hope you get which is the healthiest answer. So this is what's happening here. Longing. It's not that the author is saying, oh, Bhagavan has these qualities, and I'm so ashamed, I feel so bad about me that I don't have them, and he's so far away, and I got depressed. And that's the end of the verse. He's saying, wow, with beholding that, my heart thirst is can only increase. So anyhow, the verse, just to go full circle, the verse began then with Krishna being conquered, even by the smallest gesture of love, line one. Second line moves to his refusal to retaliate against injury and attack, but smiling, big smile. And then comes his inability to remain untouched by other people's suffering. And then it ends, with the devotees becoming, as Krishna is becoming unable to remain untouched by people's suffering. The four lines, the devotee becoming unable to remain untouched by Krishna. When you realize how touched Krishna is by everything, you can no longer remain untouched yourself. It's moving, it's melting. Divine sensitivity awakens human sensitivity. How sensitive Bhagavan is for everything and everyone starts to make us sensitive to that, to everything. And Krishna's gratitude and Krishna's tolerance and Krishna's compassion then becomes the reason the heart wants Krishna. So attractive. That's why it's called Krishna, the all-attractive, or Hari. One who steals away. These names are not just casually like ascribed or manifest. They are really, he is not different from his name. Remember. So whatever those names indicate, he's that. So yeah, let's begin on that note of aspiration. Because throughout this series, we are concluding now officially our morning series. So throughout this series, we have share different verses and different beautiful noble ideals, and at times maybe some of us felt that's a big ideal and far away, some shame may came to visit, but let's turn all that into aspirations. Let's see all our experiences these days as sowing seeds of longing. So we have a clear prospect, a clear aspiration, and even if we are miles away, lifetimes away from that, we can turn all that into longing. We can feel our life with the fire of longing and aspiration and feel fortunate to be on that, already on the path to that goal and treading the path with longing. I'm trying again, hopefully, to reflect deeply how this speaks to me where I am now, how all these verses are relatable to me where I am now. And how can I also embrace these verses in short term, middle term, long term, aspirationally? Okay. That was today's verse, today's portal. Perhaps that's one way to summarize the whole retreat. The more we contemplate who we should, we are invited to contemplate who God is, like we are doing today, and we have been doing these days, until what we see in God starts awakening us, desire to become more like the one we love, as we were saying, to become more fully human and fully divine. That's who Bhagavan is. That's who we are invited to become. That's how we kind of start to relate more in term in the same terms with our adorable worship, our object of adoration. Yeah. To become more godlike in that sense. Hopefully something of that happened these days, so we can consider our yajna, our morning sacrifice, a success, as we are putting it to rest today. And we'll do some little closing exercise, if you allow me to do. And then later we also will have one last contemplation of this verse with some prompts and some little sharing to hopefully for continue to internalize it, make it flesh in us. So I'll share the prompts. There are three prompts, each one connected to the three main first qualities of the verse: gratitude, tolerance, and compassion. And then I leave the longing for you to privately continue journey. So the first prompt is about gratitude. It says like this: what small act of love or care, what small act of love or care have you received? That deserves to become larger in your awareness. Thank you, Garnish. What small act of love or care have you received that deserves to become larger in your awareness? Okay, number two. Tolerance. And we'll be repeating them later, no problem. When someone hurts or disappoints you, what helps you not harden? When someone hurts or disappoints you, it can be yourself, just in case you're doing that to yourself. But someone hurts or disappoints you, what helps you not harden? And the last one, which is connected with compassion, and to make this a little bit radically personal, what suffering do you feel invited to let affect you more deeply? What suffering do you feel invited to let affect you more deeply? And of course, you're taking notes of that, so you can. I know that I've heard many times. So 2 minutes for each one, we deserve 2 weeks for each one. So you take notes, you continue sitting with those questions whenever you feel like it. What suffering do you feel invited to let affect you more deeply? Okay, I'll stop the recording here. Chila Rupa Goswami ki jai, Sadhu Sangha ki jai, Gaur Premanand.